Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, joined again today by Joshua Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. I detect a little more of a spring in your step.
Yeah, you know, I think we just finished spring break, kind of in that final push to the end of the semester. Both my kids in school, we're obviously teaching a course together, and it, you know, I can see the beginning of summer just over the horizon.
Yeah,
you know, and I want it. I want it bad.
Yeah, no, I you know, yeah, a couple, you know, even just to have a few more free weekends, you know,
yeah,
would be, you know, okay.
A little less foot traffic, just a little slower pace. I'll take the heat. You know, it's fine.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I'm
ready. I'm ready.
So, you know, today, you know, we've been fairly focused topically, I think, for the last few podcasts that we've done.
I'm trying to think.
Yeah,
it's a funny thing to say.
I mean, it is hard to remember.
Well, and it's just funny to hear you say, oh, well, we've been focused. And I'm like, oh, boy, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I should put it this way. We've at least been thematic.
Yes, we've been thematic. I'll take
right.
that. All right.
But even then, I mean, you know, we talked about the war. We talked in the impact of the war. We talked about the
No, there's some pretty deep dives.
There's some reasonably discreet topics.
And, yeah.
You know, I think both as a reflection of the environment and the interest in it, today is – you know, a day, I think, to look at kind of what are the signals out there in this interim election period that we're still in.
Right.
I mean, the election is still the underlying driving force here,
mm-hmm.
you know, allowing for obviously the, you know, external shock, if you will, mm-hmm. of the war in Iran.
Right.
I think we should probably just say the war in the Middle East now.
Right. Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, we could look at a few of the signals in this interim election period where mm-hmm. we're not, because of the runoffs and the high visibility runoff on the Republican side in the Senate race, we're not out of the primary season quite yet.
Right.
You know, there's a Godfather 3 thing there. Every time we think we're out, they drag us back in. But also, in other ways, the general election is underway because most of the primary races are settled, et cetera, other, you know, with these, the major exceptions. So I thought we could just do kind of see what's stirring out there in terms of both the structural elements out there, campaign maneuvering that's going on in this transitional period between the primary and the general election campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and kind of just think about what we're seeing out there. You know, I think, you know, we have to start, you know, we've already kind of done this a little bit, but saying, you know, there is a big thing going on. I mean, the war in Iran, its secondary, tertiary effects obviously have had a major impact on the context and what's going on. I mean, we did our segment yesterday for the intro level class in our, I think we've mentioned them on here. We do this thing called Unpacking the News for the intro students that tries to talk about something going on in the current environment and tie it to content in the class. And we did the stuff on the war yesterday for this week's segment. And if people have, you know, if you're teaching and you want to use this, I think we posted everything on the YouTube account.
Yeah.
So there's the Texas Politics Project YouTube account. Should be reasonably, you know, it's probably not going to pop up in your marquee feeds, but
you're looking for a little freshman intro government.
I don't think the algo loves us that much, but it's easy to find if you just Google Texas Politics Project, or put Texas Politics Project in the search in the YouTube search window.
And can I ask you a question? I mean, I've been thinking about something as you're talking about this, and it is interesting in that, you know, we'll get into this a little bit more, but you know, we do still in Texas, obviously there's a foot in the primaries, as you said, and yet it does still feel like the next election is really just driving a lot. And I think, you know, on the one hand, I was just sort of thinking about like why that's the case. And we'll get to some specifics later. Because, you know, obviously, in some ways, you know, there's a long time to the election, right? I mean, we kind of talk about this all the time that, you know, for people like us and people like you probably, you're paying a ton of attention. But for most people, like the real campaign, the real like focus on the races doesn't really start until after the summer, which we're not even in the summer yet. Summer's over the horizon. Right. And I wonder, you know, if this, I mean, because, you know, not I'm leaning on your longer experience here.
It's nicely put. Thank you.
But I wonder if this feels a little bit different right now, because it seems like it does. I mean, this almost always, you know, not always, but I mean, historically in my experience here, after the primary is over, it's almost like there's like a lull. There's a little bit of a quiet period often.
You know, people leave town.
You know, and, yeah. Well, you know, and like candidates usually aren't looking to spend a bunch of their money yet, you know, that kind of thing. They're trying to raise money. And I wonder, you know, if you do feel that like overall, like the election is still kind of like driving a lot of the action, I'm thinking to like the answer for like why that would be the case. And it seems to me like it's like kind of the obvious answer for everything in some ways. Like, is it just Donald Trump? Is it just the fact that Democrats are so unified around the next thing they can do? And I'll add one more piece to that and I'll, you can respond, which is, you know, is it just Donald Trump? Is it also just the overall clear, just kind of like, I don't know, you can use any word you want here, degradation, ineffectiveness, whatever, of institutions to actually do something, right? So right now, there's all this stuff going on. There's concerns about prices. There's a war going on. And the institutions are essentially in this stasis in some ways, you know, I'll say against the executive branch, not against, but as contrary to the executive branch, which is just moving.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, you know, is that sort of like why, you know, in some ways for Democrats, like what else is there to focus on besides November? You know, they've got very little, you know, plays to make. Is that what you're thinking? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I, you know, I guess I'm thinking when you first started talking about that, I was focused on the state.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking more about the national environment as a way of responding to this. I mean, I think nationally. Mm-hmm. Your roundup of the usual suspects makes a lot of sense to me that, you know, with, you know, and this gets us kind of into what we're talking about, which is, you know, there's all these discrete things. There's all, you know, we'll hit, you know, there's a lot of little things, and, you know, we've got this kind of shopping list of things we can choose from. And that's all kind of out there. And I think that's the question I'm kind of wrestling with in my head, honestly, is at the national level, I think this usual. So, at the national level, I think your roundup of the usual suspects is the right group of things to look at.
Yeah, you know?
It is the continuing ability of Donald Trump to just drive the discussion,
right,
and to drive public attention. Although I think it's also in a slightly contradictory sense, a little bit of the degradation of his effectiveness in doing that.
Yeah.
In other words, and it's just, we talked about this, I think, a couple of weeks ago. We kicked around very tentatively this idea is, you know, are the conditions and the effects of Trump's success and his position beginning to degrade a little around the edges?
I think so.
And all much. And we kind of decided yes, but sort of tentatively so. But I think in the three or four weeks since we had that discussion, in part because of the war, in part because of the shutdown of TSA.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing a little more of that. And I think that is kind of part of the answer to your question.
I want to jump on something there real quick because I think it's a good opening for it. Like for me, I agree with you. And where I see that is not in the way that I think people would normally think to see that. Just to be really clear, it's not as though you're seeing a bunch of like Republican senators saying, hey, you know, I don't know about this war.
Right.
You're not seeing any sort of, you know, candidates and potential candidates on the Republican side creating a bunch of distance between themselves and Trump. But what I look at, and this is sort of what I was talking to a lot of reporters about last week, was, you know, there was the deadline for either Paxton or well, anyone to drop out of the runoff, basically.
Right.
And there was a lot of questions last week from reporters about, you know, well, is Trump going to, you know, is he going to get involved? If he does, blah, 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 blah. And we talked a little bit about this already. And you all probably have a pretty good sense of it. Ultimately, he didn't endorse anybody. And, you know, I keep kind of coming back to this thing, which is, you know, you can learn a lot about, I think, the Trump administration and what Trump is seeing and hearing and thinking about by what he does or doesn't do. And in some ways, you know, like my view of that is if he could have endorsed and it would have been effective, whether in the runoff, whether in the first primary, whether in getting somebody to drop out, he would have done it. And the point is that he didn't because it wouldn't have been. Paxton wouldn't have dropped out. Cornyn certainly wouldn't have dropped out. Like, it was not going to be effective. So at the margins, to your point, it's already less effective. I mean, it's already the case that he's not able to go in and say, all right, listen, get out of here. Because you know what? Ken Paxton is going to run again for office probably after Trump is out of office. So is potentially John Cornyn, maybe not John
Cornyn.
Probably not John Cornyn. But a lot of these people are. And so that sort of hold in that power. And I think the thing that's sort of useful about Trump is he's not going to expose himself, right, in that way. Like, he's not going to go and do something that be
not in this context.
Not in this context and be seen as ineffective. I said that was a little that was a little setup.
Thank you.
But I think that's part of what I'm looking at now. It's not so much like what's right in front of your face. It's almost like, well, what's not happening? And, you know, kind of, and that's where I'm sort of seeing the edges of this a little bit. You know, his sort of command and control over everybody is starting to loosen a little bit.
Right. Right. And just a little, but enough, you know, be enough to have an impact. So I think in terms of, so the way you initially posed that, I also think then to look at Texas, I think the other reason that there's a little bit more, you know, these stirrings of maybe earlier attention than usual, you know, is because of the focus and the visibility and the national attention on the Senate race.
Yeah, and the money. I mean, just
you know,
to say
it's
going to
recede.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, the money kind of is baked into that, I think, or, you know, helps drive that. But I, you know, that has receded some, but it's still, I think, maybe a slightly different version of this. And I was thinking about how to raise this before we came in here. I mean, I do feel like I'm having a lot more casual conversations outside of the usual suspects with people about the election.
Absolutely. I agree.
In Texas, it's mainly the Senate race.
That's my experience, too.
Yeah. And so I don't want to go too far with that because even outside of my, you know, our usual social circles are not. You know, it's not that broad.
I go hang out on the job site all the time.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I mean, one wants to be measured about that.
Right.
But I mean, so I think that's, to me, that's what we're trying to figure out here. I mean, I thought we'd just talk about a few of the things going on and, you know, it's kind of a pointillist approach or maybe, you know, less pretentiously, just a vibe check.
Yeah.
You know, and so let's talk about a couple of things. So, I mean, let's look a little bit at kind of what's going on. I mean, we've talked about this. I mean, I think the way you can kind of divide this is, you know, what's kind of more forward looking in the way that we're talking about in which the general election campaign is beginning.
Yeah.
The environment is really about that.
Right.
Or there's a general election campaign environment. And then there's the lingering kind of effects of the primary or something that's still a little more rooted in that. Let's start with like the kind of expected one, the one that movement we would expect in the direction of general election competition between the two parties. And one of the things I think that's worth pointing out is that in the last couple of weeks, we have seen some Republican groups already working on softening up James Tallarico.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he has a pretty, you know, extensive record of comments and various things that obviously have been combed through and, you know, pulled apart for various, you know, partisan reasons. And that's, I think, to be expected. I mean, whatever. That's, everybody who runs for office knows that's going to happen. I think the question that I have, you know, from where I'm sitting, you know, is it too early? And I mean, and again, this goes back to kind of normal operating procedures. You know, James Tallarico might be well known among Democrats, and I think the idea now is to drive up his negatives among Republicans, obviously, and that makes sense. But as we were talking about, you know, I wonder, I guess, I mean, I'll say this. On the one hand, I don't think they want a Beto O'Rourke situation where they kind of sit on it. They kind of let this guy build up his name ID, build up goodwill, build up his, you know, brand among independents. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we've got a problem on our hands.
Right.
So I think they've learned from that. At the same time, you know, there is this sort of other thing where, you know, generally campaigns are a little reluctant to do anything to raise the name ID of their opponents. And again, these aren't the campaigns. These are other groups who are spending this kind of money. But you do kind of wonder, I wonder, you know, is this too early? And this is, if, you know, you've got an Oppo file, you want to dump it. Do you want to dump it now? Or do you want to dump again to, when more people are paying attention more regularly to this kind of stuff? I think it's an open question. It's a strategic question. I mean, in some ways, you know, once you've said it and it's out there, like it's out there, okay, you know, he responds and moves on. Like, yeah, we talked about this last spring or whatever.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that it's an interesting comparison to what we've seen on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. I think what we've been talking about, yeah, in some ways for a few years now since the Paxton impeachment, which is at a certain level, Ken Paxton's political viability reflects the fact that a lot of negative information is out there.
Yeah.
And it's baked in.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I think to your observation about that, the question is, could the attacks on soft, you know, the efforts to soften Tallarico up, as I've said, fall into that trap where by the time you get to the general election, people feel like it's old news. Like, yeah, when he was state legislator, said there were six genders, or you know,
yeah,
whatever all of this OPPO research stuff is. And I don't know. And what? I think there's another element of that that I want to put a pin in for a minute. But I think the interesting thing about this is that it does speak to the tension at the heart of the Tallarico candidacy and the Tallarico brand that we talked about a little bit during the primary, but that is now
a little bit
in more full flower, which is on one hand, you've got this argument that, hey, James Tallarico is this kind of fits the mold of a young, progressive, white, Democratic candidate, but that also has mainstream appeal. The sharp part of that, obviously, was the racial component of that during the Crockett-Tallarico competition. But that, you know, clearly the brand of the Christianity, we were kind of poking at this when we did that look at religious views of him. That's kind of why I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of thing where you've got this guy that can not alienate the progressive wing of the party and the progress, you know, this drive for a more to move the party to the left.
Yeah.
But also the kind of argument that he still has appeal to non-democratic constituencies.
Yeah.
And that was just lurking during the primary. Now that these attacks are being launched by the other party, I think that lays bare that challenge for the Tallarico campaign.
Yeah.
Which is, how do you respond to that? And how do you square that circle?
Yeah, I was thinking—
Or circle, know, that square.
Sort of two things. Is one, I thought you were going to go somewhere else at the beginning, actually, so I'll hit that one first, actually, which is, you know, in some ways, if Paxton becomes the nominee, you know, the OPPO research file on Paxton is pretty deep, right? And, you know, we can have, you know, a more sophisticated discussion, not today or whatever, about, you know, how much of that information has really made its way out, you know, into the electorate. I think that's something of an open question. But if you're Republicans looking to maintain that seat in Republican hands, and you think that there's a, you know, look, right now, 50-50 chance, let's say, that Paxton's the nominee, and I think that's probably a relatively, you know, I could probably think a little bit more about that, but I think that's where we are. Then, you know, if nothing else, it seems that it's probably valuable to muddy the water as much as you can. Because if, you know, there's two problems. I mean, there's a problem that Paxton has vis-a-vis Tallarico, and then there's a problem that Tallarico has vis-a-vis Tallarico, I think. The problem that Paxton has vis-a-vis Tallarico is that Paxton's, you know, base of support has often been tied to his conservative credentials, his leaning into religion, and then all the negative OPPO research going to come out is going to put a dent on a lot of that.
Well, look, I would say this. The way that they, you know, we should say this having it, because it kind of follows on the other point. I think it follows where you're going, which is the other side of saying that a lot of the negative aspects of Paxton's candidacy and Paxton as a person and a candidate have already been baked in among people. The other side of that is that it's been baked in with the help of a trope in the Republican Party that the liberal press, the haters, just want to drag down everybody like they tried to drag down President Trump.
Right.
And I think highlighting that mechanism, I think, is kind of important.
Yeah.
Because it's not ideological. It's not so much it's another dimension.
Yeah, and I think it gives, you know, and if you know, you can imagine a debate where something comes up along kind of a moral, ethical dimension, and it gives Paxton more, you know, Paxton potentially, or Cornyn really, more avenues to deny Tallarico a potential high ground. Now, I think Tallarico also has a challenge here because, I mean, and I'm trying to figure this out. Someone is, you know, people have been asking me about this more and more, and you already laid this out. I mean, for all this focus on his religion, he's a pretty standard progressive candidate. I mean, if you look at his policy positions, it's not as though, I mean, people have asked me, you know, are there places where his religion clearly like takes him into a different place than we would expect a Democrat to go? And the answer is, well, not really.
Well, right. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, and I think that is part of that contradiction I was talking about, right? Which it's one end go, hey, he can talk about Christianity. It's like, yeah, but the way he talks about Christianity is not, does not have universal appeal.
Right.
You know, period.
Yeah, and so I think this is, you know, I think this is all...
And all of that is coming out right now.
Yeah, so I think now that we've had this discussion, I'd say, you know, it's probably not too early given the constellation we're talking about, given the fact that, like, look, the one thing that's going to go on the Republican side is they're going to continue to tear each other down. So long as Cornyn is spending a bunch of money tearing down Paxson and Paxson spending less money comparatively trying to tear down Cornyn, having another line of messaging out there that's about this other person who's definitely going to be in the race, it seems like probably a good investment.
I think that's right. I mean,
if a little early.
And just from a pure tactical position, I could see people sitting around, you know what? Their primary is resolved. There's probably a presumption of the same kind of dynamic that we were referring to, that our gut feeling is, okay, primary's over. Let's take a breather.
Mm-hmm.
And one way to sort of vector off of the disadvantage that Republicans now have because they have to manage this runoff, say, well, you know, let's not waste this time.
Yeah, let's not take our eye off the ball here.
Let's go ahead and, you know, launch a few salvos here and keep them occupied.
Yeah.
And, you know, make them do some things. And so there's a real tactical, I think, possibility here.
Yeah.
And also from the, you know, to the extent that outside groups are doing this, I mean, I you know, from a kind of impressionistic, gossipy perspective, it's kind of willing, Paxson campaign has not wanted to spend a lot of money.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of money.
They don't have a lot of money. They don't want to spend it. And so there are reasons for this. But I think the thing that I really am kind of thinking about is kind of the overall point here is that this is going to be an interesting early test for the Tallarico campaign.
Yeah.
And to see how they respond to this. So, you know, I think another thing that we're seeing in the kind of general election environment, and this is definitely a bit more pointless, but also – I think kind of, you know, one of the, you know, something that really kind of preoccupied people for a couple of days this week and, you know, in Austin, and that is kind of stirrings in the ledge as indicated, you know, first and foremost by the announcement of committee chairman, by committee chair assignments, by Lieutenant Governor Patrick and committee assignments, and then, you know, the dust up that occurred because he did not assign Taylor Remmert. The Democrat who carried out this, you know, pulled off the surprise win in SD9, the Hancock seat, you know, they didn't put him on committees and, you know, that resulted in a bit of back and forth between the lieutenant governor and Senator Remmert.
Yeah. How unusual. So like,
I think one can make too much of this.
Yeah.
It's out there and it is a sign that, you know, there is a lot of attention to the general, you know, there's some attention to general election environment going on here. You just unpack it reasonably a little bit. Just, you know, the argument that Lieutenant Governor Patrick made, not quite an institutional argument per se, is that, look, this guy's not going to win. That's a Republican district. This is a fluke. You know, I'm not going to bother.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting position to take, you know.
And then, the remnant for not going, hey, I was duly elected. You're depriving the people of SD9 of a representative, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, honestly, that's a really, I mean, look, I don't think it makes a difference, but I'm sure whoever ends up being the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor is happy that this has happened in some ways. I mean, not for Taylor Remmert, because, I mean, ultimately, these are interim committees, you know. I'm kind of throwing my hands up. Yeah, you know, okay.
Right.
We can make more of this than it needs to be made of, but the idea that, you know, Dan Patrick is going to spend, you know, however many millions of dollars or direct however many millions of dollars to try to defeat this person in a special election, fail, and be like, I'm just not really going to, like, let you represent anybody right now. I don't know. I don't know if that's a good look. I mean, I'll just say, like, I just don't think that that's, you know, for someone who's been in the institution as long as he has and the position that he's been in, I don't think it's a good look for using your power, but does it matter? Probably not.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, I mean, I guess what I would, my response to that would be, and I'm sure this is part
it's
of
it's a vibe check. We're doing vibe checks right now.
Good luck for, you know, to whom?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is this is, to use the metaphor locally, this is an inside the beltway story crazy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
But if anything, it might give, you know, you were talking about, it might give about the lieutenant governor's race. It gives Remitz something else to talk about.
Yeah.
In the campaign to hang on to that seat.
Yeah. He gets to run as the person Dan Patrick doesn't want in the Texas Senate, which I think is, you know, that's probably not a bad.
He's not being posed as, you know, as opponent of Lieutenant Governor on Colbert or anything. So, you know, there's a limited return on it.
Right.
But it's there. I think that's right. And then I think, you know, the other thing I kind of noticed out there another thing I kind of noticed out there in the ether that is not so much about party competition, but the fact that there does seem to be some falling back on the effort to do away with voting centers at the county level in a couple of these places after the debacle in Dallas.
Yeah. And Williamson, that's true. And Williamson County's also had the same.
Say that again?
Williamson County had similar problems.
Right, right. And I think it's Williamson that has said they're going back to voting centers. Right?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
And so, you know, that's an interesting, you know, bit of general election fodder out there. Because I do expect, and I suspect you do, certainly at the national level, voting election practices are very much in the mix,
right?
Because of President Trump's push for Congress.
Well, this is, you know, this
to pass national restrictions on voting and et cetera, et cetera.
This is a super interesting story in some ways, and it's probably almost underappreciated in a lot of senses. To the point that you're making, in the sense that, like, right now, you know, to the interesting intersection of Texas politics and national politics, or one of them is the SAVE Act, right? In the way that, you know, we talked about this last week, the way that Paxson tried to use, you know, sort of his whatever, you know, leverage he felt like he had over whomever to try to force passage of the SAVE Act in the U.S. Senate. And I think what's interesting about this is, you know, this is a really good example of how what seems like maybe reasonable, you know, changes to election practices can have really big consequences. And the gist here, just for people who, I think, you know, I'm gathering all of a sudden that we have some listeners outside of Texas. So just real quick, early voting in Texas is about 2 weeks. During early voting, you can vote in anywhere in, you know, you basically, you know, your voting area, right? Your city, wherever it is, whoever's really the county, that's what it is. And whatever the county is, any voting location. If both parties agree on election day, you can also vote anywhere in the county, if they agree to countywide voting.
Right.
Now, if the parties disagree that they're not going to cooperate, then on election day, everybody has to vote in the precinct they are assigned based on, you know, basically the voter registration.
Kind of, you know, and look, supporters of this will say that's the way we've done it for most of the country's history, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of those sort of, you know, I put this in quotes, common sense arguments.
Right. Like voter ID.
Yeah. That just sort of you say, oh, okay. Yeah, sure. That's how we used to do it. The problem is, and this is the problem in Dallas, and it was the problem in Williamson, and it was the problem for both Democrats and Republicans, was that if they're used to voting wherever is convenient on the way to work, after dropping their kid off at school, whatever, well, now they either have to drive to some other part of town or just not vote.
Right.
And I'll tell you what, you know, in a primary election, those are some engaged people usually, more engaged than average. And you know what? They're pretty pissed if they have to drive, you know, to some other part of town because somebody decided something that they just honestly— we're not paying any attention to, because nobody pays attention to this kind of stuff.
And look, anybody who's voted on election day knows that it gets more crowded at the end of the day.
Gets more crowded at the end of the day.
Morning and then the end of the day.
Right. And so I think this is one of those interesting things where it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like we're going to count everything by paper. We're going to do paper ballots. We're going to count everything. And there have been a couple little attempts and, you know, sort of, I would say, flirtations with that here. And they've been kind of disastrous. And so this is the whole thing. We can, you know, sort of say there are these common sense things. This is the way that everybody used to do it. We should change federal voting rules so that they say this. And this is to say, this was like a relatively minor change, and it was like a pretty big problem. It was swiftly addressed by the public, and the parties have responded pretty swiftly. It's like, well, we're not doing that again. Our bad.
Right.
But like, you know, if you say like 6 months ago, was anybody in the decision-making really acknowledging the possibility of problems with this, even though they were pretty foreseeable? No.
I would disagree only slightly with that, in the sense that there are people that would tell you, you know, mostly Democrats, but also some Republicans who are trying to be discreet about it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is not going to lead to a clear partisan advantage from the Republican side on the Democratic side. So this is going to cause problems.
I guess I would say is there's just not a lot of incentive for many Republicans to say, geez, paper ballots? I don't know. Like, you know, like.
Well, and that's why I think it wasn't more decisively, you know, nipped in the bud.
Right.
But I mean, so I think all that is going on. And the broad point here is it's time to start watching that stuff again,
yeah,
I guess.
For sure.
You know, oversimplified point, but.
I think so. I mean, I think this is the ongoing discussion.
To your point, that these things get made and people are quibbling about them and they seem technical and they seem marginal or marginal and or common sense. And there are always some people either loudly on the Democratic side usually going, no, but also on the Republican side going, well, are we sure we want to do that? And it's time to start watching all that stuff again.
Well, it's really interesting just because if you think about the one from last time, it was, well, you know, if you're going to do a mail-in ballot, you know, you need to make sure that you provide us with your driver's license or social security number, whichever one you used when you applied to vote in Texas. And again, speaking of who's the one using mail-in ballots, well, mostly people over 65, maybe they don't remember when they registered to vote what they used. And so, you know, these sorts of things are like, they seem like these small things, but then ultimately they don't necessarily provide a partisan advantage. They sow more distrust in the system. And to your point, that's why they're very important to start keeping an eye on, because there is a definite, I think there's obviously been an incentive to sow distrust in the system. It continues. And honestly, some of the actions that have been meant, that have been, I'll say, have been framed to create more trust in the system might actually be having the opposite consequence.
Yeah, I think that's an utterly fair proposition.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so let's, you know, then look back before we get out of here on just a few of the lingering effects of the intra-party tensions that surfaced in the that were surfaced by the primaries.
Yeah.
I would say especially in the, you know, more on the Republican side than on the Democratic side, although we kind of backed into something on the Democratic side in talking about some of the lingering tensions around James Tallarico. I think I did a panel for Pat right after the election, and Gromer Jeffers Jr., friend of the podcast and the project and longtime Dallas reporter, and I asked him on that panel as a follow-up how serious he thought the lingering anger, negative energy on a racial basis over the all-red Tallarico dust up were in the Dallas area. And, you know, he thought that they were there.
Yeah.
You know, that he said, you know, I think Groomer, he pitched it at kind of an intermediate level, if you will. I mean, in other words, it's very Groomer.
Yeah, I was going to say,
he was careful, but direct in saying, you know, it's not a huge problem, but there are some things that have to be dealt with there. That's to paraphrase what he said. So, you know, that's there too. But there's been some pretty, you know, high profile rock throwing in the Republican Party in the last few days. I think thing that is probably, I was mentioning, you know, the insider attention on the Patrick move on committees and the Remit thing, but the thing that got the most attention was this rock throwing between Attorney General Paxton and Acting Comptroller Kelly Hancock. You know, the comptroller is conducting an audit of the AG's office, sent them what I would call the classic strongly worded letter.
Yeah, I love a strongly worded letter.
with some pretty sharp barbs in it aimed at the Attorney General. And, you know, most people in Texas will remember, but if you're not following this as closely, remember Hancock was somebody who voted to convict Paxton.
Yeah.
In the wake of the impeachment. Obviously, neither has forgotten that.
Yeah.
You know, and Attorney General Paxton is attached, the comptroller, I can't remember, I don't have it right in front of me, used some pretty nasty, you know, personal language. But this has also has some other secondary effects having to do with Greg Abbott's support for Hancock.
So I was going to ask you.
You know, Scott Braddock at Quorum Report had a pretty good post on Quorum Report unpacking some of, you know, it was a good reminder of the history there, I would say.
Yeah, I agree.
And how that all, you know, unfolded, what the backstory is on this. But that has been pretty rude and has brought out a lot of things, I think, secondary things. Again, no news about Ken Paxton there.
No.
Right, either in his approach to this or the criticisms or the divisions and the opposition that he's generated in some corners of the party. But it also kind of dragged Governor Abbott into this in an interesting way because it underlines the degree to which, and I'm trying to think about how diplomatic I should be here.
I'm watching.
That Hancock was, you know, kind of a weak sister as a candidate for comptroller. You know, both from the time that he was installed in the mm-hmm. office and Scott Braddock's piece reminded pretty pointedly about the constitutional backflips that had to happen to appoint Hancock without getting to all the details, because he was a seated senator at the mm-hmm. time. Constitution, prevented him from taking, being appointed to an executive office. So they made him chief of staff. And then once he was chief of staff, the governor, in a somewhat improvised exercise in nominalism, then declared him acting comptroller shortly thereafter. Braddock was pretty negative about that. And the governor did take some heat on that, having to do with, that drew a little bit of attention, I think, to the difficulty they had in filling that spot once Glenn Hager decided he was going to go take the other gig. Anyway, we don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but this contention between Paxton, Hancock, the illustration that there is some friction with the governor there is all very interesting and... not the kind of thing you want really floating out there. And obviously the other thing floating out there is just to complete the circle so it's clear, what Paxton did was criticized Hancock on a number of counts and then in response to this audit and then urged the governor, to basically get rid of Hancock and, hey, you might as well just appoint James Huffines now or Don Huffines now.
Yeah.
To step back on this, I will say this.
That's really...
Whatever you think of Ken Paxton.
Yeah.
The guy has shown some political... the guy and his team have shown some pretty sharp political instincts. If you go back a few weeks to the move you mentioned in terms of saying he would drop out of the race if the Senate did all these things the Senate's not going to do.
Right.
This was also, I think, a pretty,
to me,
pretty good shiv.
And I hadn't heard all that stuff because I had a question, but I think
you've sheer political.
You've kind of done it. You've by squaring the circle. you've done it for me because I'm sitting here. I'm thinking to myself, and I'm just saying real quick, just speculating on some things here. I'm just thinking about some things that I've been saying and thinking about that I think attached to this, which is, and hearing all that, my first question is sort of like, well, how much does, in principal agent terms, how much. Is Abbott directing Hancock's efforts towards the AG's office is a question, or is involved, or where, whatever, right? And we just don't know.
We don't know, but we do know is that.
But
it is a pretty known fact that the governor exerts a lot of command and control over the executive branch, allowing for the, plural executive, yada yada.
Yeah, and then there's two interesting things to that. So before getting to the second part with Paxton and the response, which I love, by the way, is just watch Observer Politics. Golf clap for that one. But basically, it seems to me that when I'm thinking, what's the argument for Abbott here? Regardless of bedfellows, allies, whatever, it's what I keep telling a lot of people is that the sort of one of the big overarching factors in this election coming up, outside of all the the big currents that we're talking about, the other thing that I always say to people is, you've got to remember, Abbott has $100 million.
Yeah,
he has a lot of flexibility. He spends
and counting.
He spends it and he spends it in a very sophisticated manner. Yeah. And if he's looking at his war chest right now, and he's thinking what a lot of I would say insider Republicans are thinking, which is that Ken Paxton's going to need a lot of money, and is going to need a lot of assistance potentially.
And he's going to create the need for more money down ballot.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And then who's the person who fills that in? Well, that's Abbott. There's nobody, that's Abbott's job at this point. He's the leader of the party here. And I think, and people know that. I mean, in some ways he's put himself in this position.
Well, no, that's the instrument. He has used his financial prowess as an instrument of authority and control of the party.
So I'd be reluctant just because I don't know enough to say, well, yeah, it would make sense for Abbott to be like, yeah, let's throw some shade over there. But then in some ways, Paxton's response almost confirms it, because hey, you know what? Why don't you just appoint the guy who ran against you before, who you really don't want? And also, you endorsed somebody else. You appointed somebody else. You clearly don't want this person as the comptroller. Why don't you appoint him now?
Yeah.
He won. Just do it.
And in terms of, how we're having this discussion about the lingering tensions of primary politics, you don't see people rub the governor's nose in it quite so explicitly as that.
No.
I mean, saying, hey, why don't you just appoint Don Huffines, as you're saying, that's pretty much,
And again, I'll reiterate the point we made last week, which I got from a reporter, which is that the one thing about Huffines is he is not beholden to Abbott.
Yeah.
He doesn't need Abbott's money, and he's going to do what he's going to do. So in terms of, for, you know, as a deal for Abbott, it's a terrible deal. Yeah. You know, so.
And it was in the Braddock piece that there was, you know, there's lingering, I think it was, maybe it was a, it was something else. Might have been a Harvey piece of crumb mm-hmm. at Quorum Report, and forgive me, guys, I can't, I'm not keeping things straight here, but you know, there is a degree to which there is always been concern, and it's of course more acute now mm-hmm. that the primary has happened, that Huffines will not be somebody that the governor can right. manage, that will not be somebody who is going to play it the way that, for example, Glenn Hager played it.
Right.
You know, which was, you know, much more subtle and, you know, that, you know, you don't think subtle when you think Don Huffines.
No.
Right.
Not the
summarize it that
not
way.
It.
So, you know, before we get out, and we've gone longer than we were going to, of course, but I think that, you know, I've got something that is partly about the emergence from the primary, but also about the primary, reflects the primary, but also is about the general election. And I think, as we're, again, stepping back and thinking about what we're seeing out there in the environment and things that are tentative signs of something, we are seeing, I think, a certain amount of trial balloons, or I'm not sure if it's even that, but these steps towards figuring out how Republicans are going to campaign in a way that mobilizes their base, mm-hmm. but manages the things that have to be avoided because of the gravitational force exerted by Donald Trump mm-hmm. and what you can and can't campaign on in relation to him.
Right.
Mainly, in other words, to put it a little too simply, what are you going to talk about that's not the, you know, in order to not talk about the economy?
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, we've seen signs that Republicans are going to try to reconfigure the immigration, the politics of immigration and their connection with cultural identity again.
I think this you is.
And little things, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and this goes back to the Abbott point and who's making decisions about what. Very a seemingly obscure story. I mean, hats off to the Texas Tribune for covering this. This decision that, you know, if you're going to seek a professional license in Texas, the Commission on License and Regulation on earlier this week adopted a new rule that said that you have to produce proof of citizenship before yeah. you can get licensed in Texas.
Brilliant move.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, taps directly into these kinds of politics in a way that recognize the kind of evolution or development on that front that we've talked about in here a lot, in the recalibration of how you mix in border security, which has receded as an issue
right.
on its own, and immigration.
Well, I think this is even better than that, because in some ways this also touches on the economic element, right?
Yeah.
Because ultimately, what are Democrats going to argue? No, we should be giving professional licenses
right.
to undocumented workers. And then the Republicans will say, oh, so what, you don't think those jobs should go to Texans? Or
but,
whatever.
You know, we also have to remember, but, you know, proof of citizenship is, you know, we'll
yeah.
see what they
yeah, exactly, we'll see what they come up with. Because
what they mean by that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I you know, it is one of these things. It's like, and again, the whole common sense, I hate the word, I hate when people say common sense in politics, because it's just almost always misused.
You got to reach for your wallet.
Oh, yeah. Well, but that's the whole thing. It's like, well, this is common yeah. sense. And it's like, hey, where's your original birth certificate? You got, where is it? No, right now. Do you know? Like,
right.
I mean, and that's, and most people say, oh, you know, some people know. I mean, I'm not saying that that's not the yeah. case, but this is for a lot of people, and especially a lot of, you know, even just not old people, just like middle-aged people, like just a lot of people, they don't have these documents all the time.
Right.
It doesn't mean they're not citizens, whatever. So this is another one of, like, you know, unintended consequences, but to the point, this is a way to talk about immigration. This is a way to tie it to, you know, potentially economic distress.
Right.
And,
yeah, that's a good point.
And it's a way to do it that doesn't criticize the president in any way, and it's in an area that they have complete control over. And I'll
right.
say, if you ever go and look at, go into some of the Texas, you know, go into some websites in Texas government, there are a lot of regulated industries that require licenses.
Oh, yeah.
It's a huge list if you ever go look for it. And I mean, so just to say, this is not like a small-ish thing. It is, you know, kind of.
Yeah, the excerpt in the lead in the Tribune story said from electricians to dog breeders. And there's a lot in between there.
There's a lot in between electricians.
And so I think the other thing, so they're, you know, a little bit of a data point on.
Yeah. Well, we're looking to see how they're going to do this. This is the thing we've been talking about a lot, is that because of, you know, Donald Trump's success on the issue and his, you know, approach to politics, Republicans can't talk about, you know, undocumented immigrants and gangs crossing the border. You know, are we going to see all the advertisements about the South American gangs infiltrating Texas right now? Probably not. So we need to see, this is the first effort in, like, well, what does this look like? How do they bring immigration back into the campaign space and talk about it in a way that's in their control? It's not critical of the president. This is an interesting first move.
And I think, you know, adjacent to that then is another thing that we had talked about and we wanted to hit, which is the evolution of the anti-Muslim discourse in the Republican Party and the tactics around we talked a lot about the campaign trope of fighting against and preventing Sharia law and how that popped up in some, you know, odd places during the primary and the ads, but frequently and was clearly, if not coordinated, seeded messaging that got it, you know, we got into a lot of nooks and crannies in the Republican primary. And how that is now going to interact with the war in Iran.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's one thing, you know, we had a piece way back during Trump's first run for office, and it was after a terrorist attack in France.
Right.
And one of the things that, you know, was going on at that point in time was, you know, Donald Trump's language towards, you know, undocumented immigrants, towards various people was still evolving and developing. And he was in some ways more, you know, this wasn't more of a normal politician at that point in time. I mean, he wasn't ever, but he wasn't necessarily as
it felt a little more familiar.
Yeah. He wasn't feeling his oats like he does now, going out there doing whatever he's, you know, trusting his instincts as much. And one of the things was, that was when he was really, you know, sort of post, you know, Mitt Romney autopsy, how's the Republican Party going to move forward? And Donald Trump was talking about rapists and murderers and all that. And there was a real discussion going on at that time, like, hey, is this going to work for the Republican Party? And then one of the things that happened after that terrorist attack in France was the conversation shifted more towards, you know, well, Muslims, what about, you know, these people coming from the country? You know, they're terrorists coming across the southern border. And that's when that kind of trope started coming up a lot more often, not that it hadn't come up before, but more frequently. And so there is a, you know, I think it's something to keep an eye on again, just like, you know, this sort of, how do we get immigration back in? You know, there's been a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric during the primaries. Now we're at war with Iran.
It's central, and it's, you know, to tie things together a little bit, and it's one of the themes in the Paxton Hancock dust up, and it's something that the Corning campaign is hitting Paxton on.
And so it's going to be,
it's not the Corning campaign. I think it's the allied groups that are running those ads.
It's something to keep an eye on. And I think, just like, you know, and what, you know, you said something before about, you know, in terms of the Republicans are focused on mobilizing their base, but they're also really focused on keeping the Democrats in a defensive position. And this is something of a greater sense. Cause again, if you think, number one, okay, so you have to, Democrats have to argue that, you know, people shouldn't have to provide, you know, proof of citizenship to work here and have a license for a profession.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to be a tough one. You know, honestly, it's tough to find a lot of allies for Muslims because there aren't a lot of Muslims in Texas to begin with. And for Democrats, you have to decide whether you want to try to protect Muslims generally, whether you want to talk about civil rights generally or human rights generally, and whether that's worthwhile. And then the other issue that, you know, has been coming up increasingly, especially from the president, is trying to sort of re-raise the issue of the existence of transgender people and transgender rights. And again, this is one of those things where I don't think this is a huge general election issue, but it's an issue that Democrats have had a horrible time addressing. And they really, as a party, don't know how to address it. And part of the challenge here is that not only do they not know how to address it, but there's no unified message. So in some sense, any Democrat is responsible for every Democrat on a lot of these issues. And that's
a good way of putting it.
And they've been really challenged with this. And so I think, you know, even if you're James Tyler Regan, you don't want to talk about, you know, transgender issues, if there's a, you know, Democratic, you know, candidate somewhere else in the state or another statewide candidate somewhere else who says something that's a little bit further out, maybe, than a Democrat said before, now it's like, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
Right? And now either they have to respond or not. And I think this is sort of what we're seeing as the shift to the general election. Yeah. Is how do you keep Democrats on the defensive?
And our state polling has shown that is a good issue.
That's a good issue for them.
For Republicans, because on some of the particular issues that Republicans have pushed on this issue, two in particular, treatment of minors and sports.
Yeah.
And there was a, and I
saw that too.
My notes are not good enough, but there's a good national report on this that we'll put on our website with a post for this podcast.
Are you talking about the polling that the Democrats have basically done? They basically acknowledge, yeah, these are bad spots for us.
Right. We, you know, we are not, the public is not, you know, to the extent that we are going, these are not areas where if we are going to be committed to to the rights of transgender people, we should not be fighting on these fronts. We should be doing it a different way.
Right.
You know, and it's a very, it's at by design,
yeah.
It puts Democrats in a difficult internal political position,
yeah.
Moving into the general, because you've got strategists kind of saying, look, having to say, we're not abandoning this constituency or their broader allyship in the progressive wing of the party.
Right.
But we have to have a serious, pragmatic conversation about, you know, what hills we're going to die on.
Right.
Right.
And that's really what the conversation is.
And it is. And so that is also, that is part of what's going on in the Democratic side. And on, you know, then the flip side of that, that's being poked at by Republicans right now pretty hard in a way that has been a little bit in abeyance.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying it ever completely went away, and in some ways it had been ramped up, but this is really coming back. I think we're in this moment. It's another one of the little points that are out there that we're waiting to see how that's going to emerge as we move into the period, and it's not going to be for a while, where more people are paying attention to this within the framework of the competition between the parties in the general election.
And importantly, I think the other thing we'll be watching in all of this is something just to tie it back, which is how effective or important are these issues relative to the economy, relative to the conduct of the war, if it keeps going on. And so these are efforts, and you know, that's why we're watching them, but it's also like there's still these big things out there that, you know.
Yeah, all of this is kind of percolating below this, the big churn.
Right.
You know, they get the waves going and you get these springs kind of feeding from the bottom, and eventually it all kind of merges together, but I don't know what it's all going to look like. So, you know, we'll resist the temptation to tie it all together. But I think these are all things we're in this period. I mean, I maybe the takeaway here is we're in this period where there's going to be two temptations, both of which have to be resisted, I think. One is which is to say, well, yeah, this is a big thing now, but it's not going to matter later. Or to say, see, this is happening. This is what the election's going to be about in October.
Yeah. Yeah.
And neither of those really work.
And honestly, you know, those are good general lessons for every election, right? Yeah. I mean, there's a certain amount of like, this thing happened. Oh my God. And it's like, hey, take a breath. And then there's also the, you know, exactly what you said. I like that because that's exactly
and
right.
And I think the volatility, you know, you posed that, and I think it helped me kind of put that all together, is the volatility in the national environment right now, I think you can't overestimate.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, OECD report came out this morning, you know, they hit the news this morning or overnight, predicting inflation at 4% in the United States.
Yeah.
If that is correct, and we are in an inflationary, and the inflation is actively going up and people are feeling it, and gas prices don't come back down, which I don't see why they, I mean, they could open the Strait of Hormuz, you know, this is not going to happen, but we could open our email tomorrow morning and they could say, hey, nobody knew it, and the U.S. and Iran and Israel have worked everything out.
Yeah, they're best friends.
And the Strait of Hormuz is open, and the price of oil will go down some, but there's already too much, I think, you know, inflationary and price increase pressure and disruption in the system right now. And we're not going to find that in our email tomorrow anyway.
Right.
You know, whole other topic of how that is all, how difficult that's going to be to unwind. So all of that going on, and I think to the extent that the economic difficulty stays broadly on the trajectory it's on, where it either gets worse or gets at best only marginally better,
right,
guarantees that dynamic, all the other things we're talking about, particularly the Republican search in Texas,
yeah,
for issues on which to mobilize their base and demobilize their opponents, is going to be, is just going to continue.
Yeah.
Right? We're just going to see more and more of that.
Right. So
with that, thanks for being here. Pretty good week.
Yeah.
Got some things done.
Almost done too.
You know, and it's, and we're almost there. So, we'll sign out by saying, be sure to look for some of the supplemental data, the podcast, some of the things we have. Hasn't been a super data heavy podcast, but lots of stuff you can find at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Go to our front page, pretty easily navigable links now to find our data resources, recent product, links to this podcast and supplemental material, et cetera. Thanks as always to our excellent production team in the dev studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin, operated by a really terrific mixture of UT professional staff and, of course, our extremely talented UT students. So thanks you all. Thanks, Josh, again for being here. Most of all, thanks to you all for listening. You'll find, again, supporting data, much more at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. We're a little on the bubble for next week, but keep an eye out. We'll pop up in your feed if we manage to get something out. But either way, we'll be back reasonably soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.